This is Mae Brussel. It is tape number 858, May the 16th, 1988. Move over, Adolf Hitler. We're getting ready for Henry Kissinger. It seems that his PR people wanted him photographed with his dog. Dog Tyler had cancer. He took it to the National Cancer Institute, and the vet came. Another one came from Wisconsin to help him. The dog died. But there was a description of Kissinger and a picture of him with Tyler. And the vet said he was talking to him totally flat out on the floor, just telling Tyler how much he loved him. And it reminded me of the extensive effort that Adolf Hitler made to be photographed with his dogs and with a lot of children around him. So I think Kissinger is the manipulator behind all the news that's taking place now. And he very quietly pats his dog, the late Tyler, and gets a description of a loving, caring person as other events come crashing down on a lot of people's heads. The little newspaper on the newsstand, The Star, which has such outrageous stories, has one inside, didn't make the headlines, but we'll see more of this later. It has to do with Larry Hagman's co-star, who's moving onto the sets of Dallas. It's none other than Alessandra Mussolini. I believe she is the granddaughter of Benito Mussolini, the niece of Sophia Loren, and she is coming to make movies for Lorimar Productions. Remember, a good hunk of that is owned by Mo Dalitz of the Mafia, the man who lived and worked closely with Robert Mayhew of the assassination teams under the guise of the Youth Organization. So soon we will see on our television Alessandra Mussolini, and the beat goes on. These people don't even bother to change their name. As a matter of fact, they're very proud of it. The television and the radio talk shows have been filled with information that is pertinent to material I've had on the program for years, and some of this I will update with you. Some there will not be time to cover, but we're simply inundated with stories, and some are new slants, some are the old slants, but the material keeps pouring out. I will do a segment in a week or two about Manchurian Candidate. Frank Sinatra was on Larry King's show for an hour. It was an interesting interview for what he left out, and I'll do some more about that. The movie is coming here to Carmel next week. I haven't seen it for a long, long time. It's owned by Frank Sinatra. So I'll see it and then share that with you. Also, we're Phil Donahue and Larry King had Don Reagan on, and he gave some revealing glimpses of himself as much as he did of the White House, and we'll do more about him, the former chairman of Merrill Lynch, and I've done quite a few broadcasts on Don Reagan and the mafia money deposited through his empire that went to Switzerland and funded Paul Waradell, and that money went to Bekir Salink, and I'll update a lot more on Don Reagan. I have that book also, but he doesn't put his past into the book. This is just about Nancy, to get even with Nancy, for he thinks she's the sole person who wanted him fired. There have been quite a few television programs, spot newses on the new evidence that came out with the Robert Kennedy assassination. Not new evidence, it's been locked up for 20 years, and the parts that were available that would prove a conspiracy are missing from what they've released, so the controversy beats on about that matter, and the Kennedy children have been on television quite a bit, Robert Kennedy's children, and of course the subject of assassination is never brought up. There was a 30-minute segment on TV on the murder of Marilyn Monroe. The only thing new about that was the suggestion that she could be killed by the mafia in order to embarrass the Kennedys rather than killed by the Kennedys to protect their politics. So that slant was interesting. And I did mention the before the half-hour segment on Vicky Morgan and two attorneys saying that her murder was a political murder to protect people high up in the administration. This coming not from the National Enquirer, but from attorneys involved in the case. And then Frontline this week is having Leslie Coburn's Out of Control. And the headlines that I'll be going into in a few minutes, again, have to do with George Bush, the CIA, and the drug connections. So this is getting more open and getting national attention on a program such as Frontline. Geraldo Rivera has had a segment with Charles Manson and Mrs. Tate. It wasn't particularly good, but it does bring up the Manson story again. And Anthony Simpson has been interviewed quite a bit for his book, Blowback, How Nazi Criminals Came to the United States. I also have that book. I'll get out a sheet maybe for you next week on books that I have obtained in the last month. There are so many of them, and there won't be time to set aside for each book to discuss it, but the pertinent thing for me is to share with you the parts left out of the books. What's there, you can see the parts they left out is always the main story. And, of course, there's been two big segments on national TV news on Inslaw, the corporation that was forced into bankruptcy by the Justice Department, and there is going to be an investigation into the perjury angles of how the Justice Department forced a judge and a person working for them to perjure themselves on the stand. So that has gone into the investigative stage out of the magazine newspaper Barron's and into possibly the courts, which would be interesting. And David Chaim has been on quite a bit of television. His book, it was reprinted. It came out 2 years ago, Contract on America, the Mafia Murder of President John Kennedy, has been the reason for his interviews. They've been very tough on him on television, and Mary Tillison on CNN and on Crossfire, Robert Novak and Tom Braden, and their feathers really get up when you talk about political assassinations and Robert Kennedy. And, of course, Chaim is no spokesman for the persons wanting to know who killed Kennedy. His book is all about the mafia. He has two pages that just simply mention General Walker, and one is that Jack Ruby said that his activities and his concerns go back to General Walker and the John Birch Society. That's where a good book, I guess I'll have to write the good book on the Kennedy assassination, takes off, as I did for Rebel with my article on the Nazi connections, and go into the right-wing angle. We've heard enough of the mafia role already. And, of course, they make good patsies. And in David Chaim's book, the second reference to General Walker is the ad wanted for treason that was paid for an associate of General Walker's. It was a full-page ad the day that John Kennedy came to Dallas. But, of course, left out of this book is the testimony of Bernard Weissman, who said they used my name because they wanted a Jewish name. And he doesn't, of course, even connect the General Walker Hotel at Berchtesgaden or the Munich people that came into the Dallas area. It's all the mafia, and, of course, they make great scapegoats. Now, regarding the Inslaw situation, that corporation that was forced into bankruptcy, I have done two broadcasts, and I'm going to do more on it. There have been some very good articles out, and a listener to World Watchers has gone to the library and gotten me the ones that I didn't have. He found some current ones. I'll give you the dates quickly in case you want to look them up. Inslaw judge points at two smoking guns. This is Washington Post, June 10th, 1987. Inslaw wins ruling against the Justice Department, Washington Post, June 13th, 1987. Justice Department is held in contempt in bankruptcy. New York Times, June 14th. These are all 1987. Judge charges Justice Department drove the firm to bankruptcy. Washington Post, September 29th, 1987. Judge slaps the Justice Department, September 29th, 1987. U.S. Judge Basin is taken off the Inslaw case, Washington Post, October 6, 1987. Also, there was a long article that was sent to me by the same person. It's titled Flash Reports on FNN, Financial News Network. And it was printed in Barron's February 28, 1988, and by the same person who wrote the article that I've been sharing with you and sending to you on Inslaw. And the author is Maggie Mehar. Now, I'm going to do at great length the bulk of this article with you and continue the other part, but just for brevity today, I would just want to bring up one point that is in this article and get back to it later. FNN, Financial News Network, is owned by Dr. Brian. He also owns 40% of the Info Technology. That's another information newsletter. And in February 1988, they bought up United Press International. Now, in describing the FNN Financial News Network, Maggie Mehar quotes the people involved with the financing and how they happened to have enough money to buy UPI. And the story is that the sudden scoop of FNN, that's the Financial News Network, of Dr. Earl Bryan and his friends, came because of the October 1987 stock market crash. And this is a quotation from the article from Barron's. It's a story FNN was born to cover, the stock market crash in October of last year. This is our version of the Kennedy assassination. Now, many of you might have read that article. Some of you didn't see it at all. But they referred to the fact that they had a scoop on the stock market crash that gave them enough money after October to then buy UPI, United Press International. Well, what did they mean by their version of the Kennedy assassination? The quotation was from FNN's news director, Eve Krzyzanowski, K-R-Z-Y-Z-A-N-O-W-A-O-S-K-I. And they said this Eve Krzyzanowski, we'll shorten it there, crowed that this was their version of the Kennedy assassination. Now, when I saw that, I immediately thought of several items that I'm going to share with you. On the day of the John Kennedy assassination, described in the book Were We Controlled, and I've had that on the program years back, for you long listeners, you will remember it. The book Were We Controlled, The Assassination of President Kennedy, it was written by Lincoln Lawrence, and what the gist of this book was that certain persons had foreknowledge that John Kennedy was going to be murdered November 22nd, 1963. And specifically, they named the Bunge Corporation, B-U-N-G-E Corporation, from Germany and Argentine. And they also had offices in New Jersey. And they made a profit of $500 million November 22nd, 1963, because it was involved the commodities market, but they sold it when it was high, just before Kennedy went through the streets of Dallas and sold it early that morning. And according to this book, they knew what they were doing because the market dropped as soon as John Kennedy was killed, and they had cleaned away at a high price $500 million. Now, just last month, April 23rd, 1988, there was an article in the San Francisco Chronicle. 1987 stock market crash, this is the October crash, is linked to the Japanese. And this isn't just a nobody making the research or the investigation. Somebody very high up, Nicholas F. Brady, was chairman of the investigative committee on the crash. He's chairman or officer of Dylan Reed, and he also led the panel investigating the crash. And he also has been named to be the Secretary of Treasury if George Bush is president. And he is also a Knight of Malta with George Bush, the two of them, and they're also both members of the Skull and Crossbones, which has nothing to do with the article. But the article says 1987 October crash linked to the Japanese. And it continues, the head of a presidential panel investigating the October stock market crash said an enormous sell-off of U.S. Treasury bonds by Japanese investors incited the plunge. And they referred to an article in Wall Street Journal, April 22, 1988. The Federal Reserve had to inject more than $10 billion into the U.S. financial system in the days following the crash, according to Nicholas F. Brady, co-chairman of Dylan Reed. And the real trigger, he said, was the Japanese came in for their own reasons and sold an enormous amount of government bonds and drove the bonds up 10%. Now, I think of the Trilateral Commission with David Rockefeller and Henry Kissinger on the board, and also Gerald Ford is on the board of the Trilateral. And the two active members who are outdoing us financially out of the Trilateral are Germany and Japan. And if people had foreknowledge that Japan was suddenly going to trigger, for what they said their own reasons, this tremendous amount of altering of our stock market, and they've been fingered as being a part of it, then a hunk of that profit went to Dr. Earl Bryan, who's very much in the news with the Inslaw case. He tries to separate himself from it, but it was that money that allowed him, who, that man never really accrued a huge fortune, to buy the United Press International, and his press secretary from the company said, it is a story that Financial News Network was born to cover. This is our version of the Kennedy assassination. Also, there was a newsletter that came out this past month. It comes out monthly, called Monitor. And the April issue is on the Klan and Nazis in the United States. And the gist of this recent issue was about the October 9th, 1987 stock market crash. And they said that the gist of the story was they hoped that this crash that would be something that they could turn the crisis to their advantage, the domestic Nazis and the Klan in the United States, that people will be fearful of those of Asian descent, and they identified the Japanese. This monitor came out before the conclusions that Japan triggered off our stock market crash, but they hope that the distinction between Japanese Oriental and then Jews and blacks would help their whites-only America, and that the very strong Nazi Klan groups in the United States are working with the stock market, with the financial empire, as I mentioned on a program not too long ago, with the AT&T affair, and they're hoping that these crashes and a depression will trigger sentiments against minorities who are taking jobs from whites and would give them the edge. So that is a long article that I will go into more from Barron's, February 28th, but I think the mention of the success of Dr. Earl Bryan buying UPI was based upon the stock market crash and knowing his contacts with people close to the financial empire. Who else benefited by the crash at that time? We know a little bit about who lost, but not who benefited. Another long article, February 28th, the same Barron's magazine, news, it's a weekly magazine, like a newspaper, but weekly. It's called Bryan's Meese Connections. That's Dr. Bryan's connections with Meese, and it goes into the companies, Biotech, Questech, their friend Edwin Thomas. It's a long article, and again, I'll do that with you and go over that material because that's the material that I had on World Watchers in 1984 when Meese was nominated to become the Attorney General. Then there were two, there's another long article in Barron's, March 21st. Scientists and stock pushers make very strange bedfellows. And this is a long article about Inslaw and Dr. Earl Bryan. Now, stock pushers, the money people and the scientists do make strange bedfellows, but it is indeed an industry. The medical profession is an industry like U.S. Steel or automobile or whatever, and it was the late Howard Hughes who said, keep the Hughes Medical Institute, medicine is the fourth largest industry in the United States, and to have a doctor, a neurosurgeon, who for all purposes only practiced 2 years in Vietnam and then went into these kinds of experiments in laboratory and news media and cancer research, etc., portends a lot of dangerous things that come to my mind. Then there were two long articles this week that may have been the reason that Edwin Meese's press representative, Mr. Eastland, just resigned. One is titled, Justice Probing Computer Firm Case. Department officials are being investigated for possible perjury. This is Washington Post, June the 6th, 1988, by Elizabeth Tucker, spelling out more trouble for Edwin Meese and going into the fact that one judge in the Inslaw case was fired, Judge George Basin, that Mr. Hamilton's attorney, Lee Ratner, was kicked out of his law office, that Anthony Pizzuto, the executive from the Justice Department, was fired. Things that I've brought up in regarding the Inslaw case, and I'll get back to, but another long article from the Kansas City Times, the same date, written by a different person, James Rowley, Associated Press, perjury investigation is looking at Meese's Justice Department. Now, the only difference between some of these headlines is injecting the name Meese in there, but as I say, the national television is making note that there is going to be an investigation of Senate committees into the Inslaw case, and I'll do more on that later, but there are a couple of other stories I want to do now and then get back to Inslaw. A very important person in terms of my research passed away this past week, and I have to spend a few moments about him because he was such a big influence in the way I studied the Warren Commission hearings. And that was Kim Philby, the double agent from British intelligence who ended up working for Soviet intelligence. San Jose Mercury, May 12th, has a long article, Double Agent, Philby Dies, Betrayal by Third Man Shook Britain to Its Roots. And the New York Times and most of the newspapers had stories of Kim Philby and his life and his father, Harry St. John Bridger Philby. He was a British colonel, an author, and the story of Kim Philby is quite open, and I don't have to go into too many details. He was very close to people in Germany just before Hitler came into power. In fact, married, fell in love with a Jewish woman, and then he realized that the Western powers were not going to be able to stop Adolf Hitler. So he went over to Spain and covered the Spanish Civil War for the London Times and for the New York Times with the intention then of really becoming an agent and finding out about fascism as it existed in the Western world. And he saw many of his friends die, and he was accused of being this far-right winger, and he couldn't blow his cover. And he worked his way up to be just about top of British intelligence, and his two co-workers fled to the Soviet Union ahead of him, two that he worked with who were high up actually in Washington, D.C., and Mr. Burgess was one of them, and McLean, and then he had to flee to Moscow, and he just died. Now, I made a study of Kim Philby's books when I was reading the Warren Commission hearings because I never had training in studying espionage. I'd never read a spy book, never saw a spy movie. So I obtained all the books on Kim Philby I could get, and the ones that I had came out in 1968 and 67. I got The Third Man. These books are available, just to tell you, in case you want to go to libraries and get them or use bookstores. The Third Man by E.H. Cookeridge, the man who wrote Galen's Spy of the Century. The Philby Conspiracy by Bruce Page, David Leitch, and Philip Knightley. That was the first one, actually, I read. The Fourth Man by Andrew Boyle, the definitive account of Kim Philby, Burgess, and McLean. Then The Philby Affair by none other than you, Trevor Roper, who wrote the introduction to Mark Lane's book, and also he is the author of the book on the death of Adolf Hitler that I believe he lied about and rushed a judgment. At the time he did the introduction to that, I didn't understand you, Trevor Roper, and hadn't studied him either. Then there's another book, The Missing McLeans by Jeffrey Hoare, and Kim Philby, The Spy I Married by Eleanor Philby, which was very revealing to me to understand Marina Oswald if they were both spies. And then, of course, My Silent War by Kim Philby. So you can see I've read each of these and studied them that I became somewhat of an authority on Philby. And what did I learn from him that helped me with my research in terms of understanding spies? There were three main things that I can recall, forgetting the incidences of special facts. One is how agents meet. He would describe, or these books would describe, and particularly his own, that he would be sent to a certain place like Istanbul, and he would take up residence there, and he would explain how he would meet other spies in the network. And he would be invited to a dinner party, and I've mentioned this on other programs before, I believe, that, and then another guest would be there. You'd have a host, and two people that didn't know each other, the host would be the source of introduction. You could meet that other person as a result of the dinner party and then see them one more time and not see them again. And both could be major spies in a particular operation. In other words, you didn't have to see each other continuously. And this was useful when I was studying Lee and Marina Oswald, when a person had a dinner party and invited Michael and Ruth Payne to the party. Anna Muller and George de Morenschild was at the party, and he met the Oswalds at that party, too. Well, the Morenschilds didn't have to, they brought the Oswalds to the party and introduced them to Payne. Then de Morenschild doesn't have to see the Paynes anymore. He can flip off from there. He has made his introduction, and the Paynes then can take care of Marina and Lee, and then de Morenschild can fade away. He doesn't have to see them again after April 19th. 63, he can go down to Haiti and just disappear. And it's the dinner party which is the excuse for their meetings, and then the control officer takes over from there. Another thing I learned was the use of relatives in espionage, because Kim Philby would go to the home of his aunt, and he'd mention her name, and he'd see his aunt and uncle. Well, aunt and uncle weren't relatives at all. Those were just names that were taken onto them, and then it was perfectly all right to tell people, I'm going to my aunt and uncle's home this evening. And they weren't relatives. They were both agents and maybe not related to each other, not even married, but playing the married role. And as I studied the Warren Commission hearings, there was a big section, or big to me, not so gigantic that anyone ever quotes it, but a selection of letters that Marina Oswald was writing to Lee when she, after she met him, and she went down to, she married him, went to a resort, a small beach resort, and she would write to him letters about an aunt and uncle, and in the testimony of her relatives, those names didn't appear. And they were in a package of material they had in the garage that the Warren Commission got a hold of, that they brought home from the Soviet Union. And then when they were living in the Dallas area, there were letters being sent to them from somebody in Fort Worth, and they had left the Fort Worth area, and they referred to the aunt and uncle of Lee and Marina, and they used the identical names that were used when Marina wrote to Lee in the Soviet Union. And they took the same aunt and uncle in Fort Worth correspondence that only went to Dallas, which is 20 or 30 miles, that was used in the Soviet Union. And this was they were code names for special packages to the power and light company, to Anna Mahler, and to the espionage network that was actually very tight in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, but looked loose. And again, I'm going to have to write about that. And also, I learned that marriages are not necessarily marriages. Two people can live together. They even have children together. And when the agency says, move on, you're going to take on a new person, or Kim Philby could leave his wife and four children, go to the Soviet Union, you simply split. These are arrangements. They're not marriages, even though you say I do and have all the proper ceremonies, but you give the semblance in a neighborhood of being married. This was depicted in the movie The Borgia Stick, how two people come home in the suburbs and open the door, and then when they get inside, they're both spies, and the only thing they have in common is the espionage work they do. So I was interested in Philby all the time that he was alive and read his books, and I do think it helped me in understanding, because this is not fiction. A lot of the fiction is based on the real world, but this is the real Kim Philby, and this is the way British intelligence works. And then, of course, William Stevenson of British intelligence came over this country and took over and helped form the OSS and then the CIA, and he lives down in Jamaica, Tyrol Bay. He's alive today. So the stories that Philby had to tell have a lot of intricate details that prove that these things do happen in this way. And so when you see them in the news or read them in accounts of assassinations and so forth, you can relate to, yes, this has been done before, yes, this is what Philby said. It doesn't necessarily have to be that way because it happened in Philby's life, but it is a clue that the possibility exists that these parties or social gatherings, or you see somebody one time, are all that you need to set up a major spy network from country to country, to just introduce one important person to another and then fade away. Now, there was an article in the Washington Post by Richard Cohn, sort of an editorial, May the 6th, titled, Why is George Bush Being So Belligerent? And the gist of this article or opinion page is that Bush has things on the candidate who would run against him, and that he's already threatening them, that he has ammunition. And being former director of the CIA, you can believe he has. And Richard Cohn said, people who know Bush say nice things about him, and all that I know is the public Bush strikes me as weird. Take Bush's recent response to a question from the press about legal troubles of the Reagan administration. Rather than answer the question, he put up his dukes, and he said in quotes, we will have some fun, too, trying to look at what is going on in Illinois or Massachusetts, depending on which one wins a Democratic nomination. You know, we have cannon fodder if you want to get into that. Later, Bush says, I hear them Democrats talking about it, but there's plenty of evidence, you know, to kind of go into a guilt by association mode where we can find corruption in Massachusetts, politics or campaign stuff or things of that nature. I hope we don't have to do it. And Richard Cohn says, writes a couple of questions. What language is the man speaking? A guilt by association mode? Cannon fodder? Ammunition? Who talks this way? Who boasts of being willing to play dirty tricks to engage by guilt by association if the mode should strike him? And he refers to him as appearing as a cowardly lion, but using words that indicate that he'll pull out some dirty stuff or guilt by association as soon as the candidate is selected by the Democratic Party, and he can get into the cannon fodder that he has and into that mode, which Mr. Richard Cohn found interesting. We'll take 1 second to turn over the other side of this tape, and then I will continue some more and then get into George Bush, the Contras, and the drug running, the stories that are in the news right now.